Amy, Hamish, thanks. Welcome to the podcast. I appreciate your time.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Gerhard.
So you're almost in my valley, or I'm almost in your valley. I'm in Invercargill and you're south of Otago, right?
Yep, south Otago, near Clinton, between Balclutha and Clinton.
Cool. And sheep and beef, or just sheep?
Yes, yep, sheep and beef farm, about 300 hectares, sort of mix of country, sort of some easier rolling stuff and some steeper gullies and hills as we back onto the Pomahaka River. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was on the Pomahaka the other day because I spoke to Bryce McKenzie for an article. I didn't get an invite to fish his farm, but I'll wangle that somehow. But
yeah, we're actually right at the bottom of the Pomahaka River catchment where it meets Clutha.
Oh yeah.
So it's almost like a lake. It's quite still, and if it floods, it just comes up like a lake. It doesn't come through like a torrent. And there's actually some nice trout and perch.
Nice
in there.
That's what I like to hear. so you, the one thing I wanted to find is you switched to regen principles a while back, right? And am I correct?
Yes, back in 2016 in May, and I went and listened to Dr. Christine Jones and Balclutha, and you know, throughout both of our careers, really, we've heard a lot about organics and just a few things that sort of bugged us with some of the things in farming. And she was the first person that really switched ideas on a way forward on what could be different. And I guess what it came back to was just our grazing management and just a bit more diversity in our pastures and our crops, and probably the trying to minimize tillage, a few things like that. I mean, it sounds good in theory, but it's certainly was a lot harder to implement than I thought.
Yeah, and if we head back to the start, if I can borrow a phrase from another farming friend who actually called herself an environmentalist, and I think we have been in farm ownership for only 10 years, really. 10 years ago, we stepped into farm ownership. And so it was that point where we sort of, you know, you become a lot more aware of that responsibility, or just the want, I suppose, to farm well and look after everything, I suppose. We sort of saw ourselves as stewards, and so you try to sort of maximize that balance between soil and animals and plants and ourselves, and sort of how do you get that mix right where you can be productive, you can be profitable, you can be happy, and yet you're actually still an environmentalist because your business is based on the land and a natural system. Land and animals, and I suppose it, you know, behind the switch to regenerative, was a whole sort of realm of things, including that responsibility of farm ownership.
Continue, Hamish.
Oh no, and it was also, we found it quite hard making a decent profit in sheep and beef on our scale, and I suppose Christine Jones is the first time I ever saw our pasture as solar panels.
Mm.
And she just nailed it right down to, like, basically you're converting sunlight into food and building your ecosystem. And I'm like, I'd never looked at it like that. And that was a huge switch for me. And
then how can you increase our profitability by just enhancing that natural system? How can we make it work for not just profit, but for everything to find that sweet spot, I suppose, in the middle of healthy everything.
How
back balance.
How would you say you looked at it beforehand? Because Hamish, you mentioned basically you know, it's like solar panels now. Did you just think maximize production? Was that just kind of that mindset?
A big part of it, yeah. I mean, it's the way you're taught and it's the way you're wired, I suppose, to maximize grass and feed and therefore meat, because that's what you're getting paid for. And even through a lot of the learning, both of us have been to Lincoln, you learn a lot about individual parts of a natural system and management and all of those aspects. But the key really is trying to put all of them together and, as we say, find that sweet spot where, yeah, you're working, and I mean, in a natural system, you'd never actually reach that perfect. Every season's different, and all of that. But I suppose that's the goal. The less inputs that you can put in and pay for the maximum output, is great. That's the ideal.
Would you say there's a stark contrast between how you farmed before region and now, or is it small changes that you made in your approach and maybe fewer inputs?
That is a good question. We probably look a little bit more similar now than we did when we first changed. because there are some very harsh realities out there. You know, if you're going to grow crops, you just need fertilizer with them. We've definitely found that. Whereas I used to think, oh, let's not use nitrogen fertilizer on the crops, or nitrogen fertilizer at all. Mm. Now I'll use it because a poor crop is hugely costly to your business, to your animal welfare. Not animal welfare as such, but feeding animals well. A poor crop and suddenly you've got to graze off stock, or you've got to buy in more supplement. There's an opportunity cost to everything. And I think that's where so many things in life, in the wheels end up falling off with where we call ourselves regen farmers. And so you're this and that. And so you just become labels, and then everyone miscommunicates, and then it becomes this big war.
Mm.
And I guess we're far more sympathetic to the fact that New Zealand farmers, they do a jolly good job without subsidies and it's just understanding some of the things that you just want to really get better at. And understanding that, you know, applying huge amounts of fertilizer year in, year out, it certainly works, and it's been tried and true for 5 or 6 decades. But I don't know. In the end, it's a non-renewable resource, and at some stage it will run out. And that could be 300 years. It could be 100. I'm not sure. But and even our soil loss from our crops, the way we were doing it with, you know, having just a single species in there, like a sweet or fodder beet, whatever. At the end of it, you've got a whole lot of bare soil, and it's quite fragile here in the winter and the spring. And so a big rain, and a lot of it washes off into our waterways. And I just had to accept that's actually what happens. And how do we prevent that? And the
sprays also with a monoculture, you know, you end up with that just invasion of white butterfly in the summer, and it's perfectly natural. I mean, you think over all Southland, Otago, I mean, flip the country's got heaps of Swedes because brassicas have changed the nature of farming for Southland and Otago. You know, we don't get grass growth in those winter months, and so having brassicas as part of your farm system has changed the game. But with that, I suppose, becomes an area where you've got a massive monoculture. So, of course, you're going to end up with the weeds and the pests that go with that. But so to answer your question, if we just come back to that, Hamish has given a couple of examples. But so, yes, if we take where we are now compared to where we are when we first regen, where we are now is definitely we're focused on the environmental low input side. We're not compromising profit. We've compromised production a little bit because that's just the way of it. So, certainly the low input, the fertilizer, the sprays, the minimum tillage, and the diverse species mix, definitely trying to roll towards those sort of ways. When we first started the regen, like anything, you always, it swings, isn't it? Big swings.
Yeah.
So yeah, we were probably reasonably extreme when we started because you're so enthusiastic. And, you know, a lot of the work has been done overseas. And yet when you bring it into a New Zealand scenario, we're a lot more intensive. We've got high debt. We're a temperate climate. So we, well, you know, generally get good grass growth all year. So there was a lot, you know, yes, you give those overseas methods a go in their pure form. But for us, you know, animal production is still key. And having huge amounts of long rank grass is not ideal for animal production and animal health.
Yeah, because so, you're losing protein, etc., right, from those grasses. Yes. The longer they get, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's a bit of a journey as you, you know, you're so passionate about it and you want it to work, and then you're like, well, actually, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
We have to accept that. So how can we adjust it so that we sort of find the New Zealand way? And Hamish was pretty awesome at that. He sort of went, know, particularly the grazing way. And, you know, we try same with the crops. Sorry, there's a lot of detail, but you try a lot of things. You know, the multi-species winter crops is another example that we tried. The multi-species is definitely good, but in terms of a winter crop, you get less yield, so therefore you need to plant more area. And so, you know, there's never any silver bullet, really.
Yeah, yeah.
There's always, you know, adjustments that need made in a system. And I suppose you sort of just got to find your way through that a little bit.
I assume with multi-species, you're having less runoff, right?
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
It's sometimes a bit disheartening when you do try these things and they work well, but they compromise your yield and they compromise some of your performance, and actually no one really cares, you know, at the end of it. You still don't get any more for your product, or the council still, or the government still want the same draconian regulations on us as they do on some intensive dairy farm, whatever, you know, that's stacked at 3.5 cows to the hectare. And all you want to be, you just want to be left alone because you know you're doing a good job, which is pretty much most sheep and beef farmers, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
And then regulations come in and they capture you in that, even though you're doing, you know you're doing a wonderful job, and you don't need some bureaucrat to pay them 10 grand or whatever
To tell you exactly that.
Yeah, it drives you.
Now you've got a little certificate. It is interesting that you mentioned that you know, you needed to kind of figure out the regen on your farm specifically and for New Zealand, because a lot of those regen principles are from America and from Africa, where there's hooved animals have been there for 20,000 years or whatever, millions of years, and the soils developed with those animals and the grasses. They're coming from South Africa. You know, you can buy native seed there that you plant, and that's your pasture. You're not bringing in something from the outside. So it's definitely going to be an adjustment to apply these principles in New Zealand. It's going to look different, but I mean, there's so many people these days that are going at it like you guys, and that should, I mean, it should pay off in some, there's going to be a New Zealand regen at some stage.
It's quite interesting that, because I listened to a podcast with a guy, Greg Judy, in America, who's one of the, you know, the pinup boys of the whole regen grazing management around the world. And what blew my mind is that they're, I think it was 2 acres per cow. And he's one of the highest stocking rates now by changing his grazing management. And, you know, people would come over here and say, you know, you can double your stocking rate. And suddenly I'm like, yeah, double your stocking rate from 4 acres per cow to 2 acres per cow. Whereas we're, you know, 10 ewes per hectare or 2 cows per hectare. And so we're, as New Zealand, we grow so much grass in comparison to so many other places of the world. So I was doing a grazing management program with a guy in Australia, and he was seeing how much grass we grew. And he just kept thinking to himself that we must have irrigation to grow that much grass, because the amount of rainfall we get here, if it was the same in Australia, they'd grow half the amount of grass. So I just started realizing, actually, we're already so
efficient
and productive. And we just need to, I guess, streamline things. You know, to sum it up for our grazing management, we went from like 10 mobs on the farm to say two mobs, 10 to two as a generalization, and simplified the grazing management. Went from 40 paddocks when we got here to, we're now at 75. And so now it's easy to manage. The graze, we can get through a lot longer periods with low pasture growth.
And that is all due to the switch to a rotational system, which is the basis of the regenerative. So in a New Zealand system, you know, conventionally you might have had, as Hamish said, 10 mobs by the time you get light use, tudus, hobbits, you name it, whatever, whereas we do run, in terms of stock, a lot more simplified system now. But it is,
And it's working for you?
Yeah. And we would, conventionally, you set stock for a decent chunk, whether it's finishing lambs or over lambing with sheep particularly, whereas we would do more rotational grazing now.
So the reason we're really talking is a bit of controversy, right? So you did you write the article for NZ Farming, or was it posted? Was it on another platform and then posted to NZ Farming? Where did it first appear?
Brash and Hyde, just a journalism platform.
Okay,
cool. More out of Auckland, I suppose.
And then that was reposted.
Okay. Yes, that's right.
And I mean, the basis of is of this is that that you were becoming confused about how to how CO2 or methane, CO2 equivalent and methane, was being assessed on farms and on your farms and on some of your friends' farms that couldn't figure out, you know, they got multiple people to assess the methane production of their system, and they got different answers. How would you, like, why did you first write the article?
There certainly is a lot of controversy. We wrote it, I suppose, from our perspective, the frustration, I suppose, when you look ahead and you see all the political drama that's coming towards farmers, and particularly sheep and beef farmers in New Zealand. New Zealand's in a unique scenario where livestock are a major proportion of our country's income. And so, therefore, we're in the spotlight, really, in terms of methane causing climate change. But the proposed implications for this, for our business in particular, is reasonably large, and something that we're not terribly comfortable with. And so from
being taxed, is that that's what you're saying, right? So you'll be... Okay, so maybe let me, for listeners that aren't in New Zealand, let me explain a bit and you tell me if I've got it right. So cattle, livestock, burp basically methane, and that causes climate change, and it's going to be taxed. Even though it's food that's being produced, let's not, you know, it's food that we all have to eat that's being produced. Well, I'm not going to even expand on that, but... And so the government, well, the previous government was going to have all farmers measure their methane emissions from their systems, from both fertilizer and or CO2 equivalents, and from livestock. And then that kind of came to a halt now with the new government taking over, but it's probably not gonna go away, right? And this is where your problem came in, that there was no clear answers as to how much emissions you had, because measurements would be different depending what company you used, for example. Is that more or less right?
Yes, that's right. And, you know, that's at farm level, but even at national level, really, there's still so many unknowns. The science is still, there's a lot of differing opinions. But even in New Zealand's scenario, so the IPCC at a national, see, IPCC at a national level say that greenhouse gases and 46% of our emissions calculator, if you like, and so therefore livestock certainly become in the spotlight under that scenario. But even at that level, as we said, you know, there is differences of opinion, and the IPCC have said that that figure is potentially overstated by 300 to 400%, which is massive.
Yeah,
And so
depending on what
even at that,
formula they use, right? What metric, GWP store, GWP 100.
That's it.
yes, that's right. So even at that level, really, there's so much uncertainty and the inability to really quantify or measure it. And so yet we're going to massively affect you know, all farms in New Zealand on something that even at that top level is really quite undecided. And yeah.
Yeah, it's you know, when it's all statistics and how you work them. So
Models.
New Zealand's got 5 million people, and we might be a similar size to Japan. You know, if we had 50 million people, then the percentage of livestock would be 10%, and so therefore no drama. But because we've only got 5 million, suddenly the livestock percentage is so much greater. And like I say, 500 years ago, when there were Indians roaming North Africa, well, there were more bison than Indians. So the bison were 95% of the emissions of America. And it's never ending, how they twist statistics, how things work. You know, like they'll say methane is 80 times more potent than CO2. Well, I mean, that's just a human construct. I mean, that's taking no time. And if you take it over GWP 100 years, well, then it's 28 times. But if you take it over 500 years, it's only 7 times. Well, let's take it over 1,000 years. It's probably completely insignificant.
So it becomes a science, an academic
It's a political
sort of
argument.
thing at this point. And so yes, at the moment the government has delayed, like the tax is not imminent at this point for us as farmers. But the reality is that there is a lot of commercial companies and government, while the tax
It's still
isn't,
there.
it's still on the table, but it's just been delayed with the new government.
I almost feel in some way that they should have made farmers calculate emissions according to a specific, you know, a national calculator. Because if you were doing that, at least you would be doing something. But now it's just hanging over your head, you know, kicking the can
Yes.
down the road was almost to the detriment of everybody, because now you don't know. You're just sitting in a position where nothing happens. If you knew you were going to be taxed X percent, great, then you could work, do something. But now you're just, again, for the next X amount of years, you don't know.
Yes, and you know, there's just, oh, I mean, there's a lot to it, but yeah, at farm level, it is quite distressing because, you know, it's hard to measure. There's not many options. We're supposedly supposed to demonstrate and calculate at farm level, which there's just a whole lot of nonsense and immeasurable stuff that goes with that. We don't really want to get into the detail. But, you know, at the end of the day, as we said at the start, we're environmentalists and we are dealing with the natural system. And it's so difficult when you just pull out methane out of all the things that are involved in this natural system that we work, and you say, oh, that's bad. Well, yeah, there's a lot of factors that go, I mean, animals, there's a reason why they are ruminants, and that is because they are grazing extensive pasture lands that are not always high quality. And so they are the animals that have been designed to fit into that scenario, and they can convert a low quality pasture or low quality forage into a high quality nutritional product.
Superfood.
Red feed, whether it be red meat, wool, or milk. And so, yeah, when you start to consider all aspects of that natural cycle that methane is produced from, it's a whole different equation, again, in terms of, as Hamish said, you know, our farms are solar panels, photosynthesis. If you want to describe this cycle, basically.
Oh, it just astounds me that if we went and put solar panels over our farm, we'd be climate heroes. But because we've got livestock, we're climate villains. It's just insane that...
And yet a solar panel would be nothing on photosynthesis. I don't think scientists can even replicate photosynthesis yet.
Was it one of your friends that tried to have these emissions or emissions measured by three different companies? What's that story? I mean, it mentions it in the article. What happened there?
That's just a number of, you know, organizations, you know, like the Dairy NZ might have their calculator, Beef and Lamb might have their calculator, another company might have, environmental company might have another calculator, and they all end up with different numbers at the end
for the same farm.
And also, it's so interesting, here they are spending money on this black hole with trying to reduce the methane output of a sheep or a dairy cow, whatever. But if an animal eats poorer quality feed, their methane rockets up because the microbes have to break down that high roughage fibrous pasture. And so there's way more variation just on how we manage our pastures than trying to reduce the individual genetic methane of any animal. And so if you want to do a farm calculator, you have to, you know, you've got to give them...
There's so many things that have to be accounted for in that equation. Mm. And, you know, even within a farm system, okay, so you take out that poorer quality feed and you start importing higher quality feed from outside. You bring in grain
or grow more crops
or whatever, you know, there's factors that change within even those systems. You might actually ultimately end up producing more, and you might use more diesel to do that. So, yeah. I mean, are you actually better off? And so these are the sort of questions that we're left sort of saying, well, what actually is it that you want? Is it just total methane, or is it methane per animal, or is it diesel production? You know, like
I don't think anybody knows, because we calculate diesel per hectare. And so we might be 10 litres of diesel per hectare, but when we were arable, we were using 200 litres of diesel per hectare. So I'm just completely confused as to what people actually want. On one hand, they want zero emissions or net zero or whatever, or oil-free, yet animals deliver sustainability. They are renewable, they're biodegradable, they're every able symbol that you can bring out there, yet they are still, as far as I'm concerned, it's just a convenient distraction away from the people having to reduce their fossil fuel consumption.
Well, you feel a little bit like you're targeted, yes, because maybe we're the easy option. I'm not quite sure. I mean, New Zealand, in the scheme of things, even what we produce is minimal, you know, like, so anything we do here is so minuscule in the world sense in terms of total food production or whatever. So it's, you do feel quite targeted as, you know, individual sheep and beef business. We're only 10 years in, we're on the smaller size of what might be considered an economic unit. So these things have a big impact on our business.
And I guess emotionally, because if having that hang over your head. Explain to me in the article you wrote about it was a phase 3 multivariate analysis of greenhouse gas emissions. Talking about how many tons of CO2 it takes to grow a hectare of grass. Can you maybe run me through that?
7 tons, yeah.
It's just worked out. If you grow
7 tons.
If you grow 10 ton of pasture,
yeah,
that pasture needs a certain amount of CO2. I mean, there's such a, the calculation, it's just, we won't even go through the calculation on how, because even that differs to different people. But let's just think about the concept for a second, that for pasture to grow, it needs CO2. CO2 is the building block of life. I mean, to call CO2 a pollutant, I just don't understand it. It's sort of a, it's like calling water a pollutant. I mean, the without water, without solar energy, and it's, so every day pasture grows.
Pasture grows, drawing down the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, converting it into leaf, green leaf, which animals eat, and then, as we said, they're ruminants, and so in order to create turn that dry matter into red meat and growth for them as animals, their stomach system does that by producing methane that is the output, I suppose.
And it what confuses me is, you know, a solar panel uses up a huge amount of non-renewable resources. At the end of it is a terrible for our environment. For it only lasts 25 years, so you got to do that. How many cycles can we do solar panels for 1,000 years? I don't think so. So on one hand, you've got this wonderful, outstanding energy machine called the solar panel that everybody thinks is amazing. But then you have some livestock who have every benefit to mankind, except they have this byproduct called methane. Mm. So,
and if we want to look at that too, in terms of, you know, let's take for instance a grain-fed system, which would in some ways produce less methane because it's a higher quality food all of the time. Mm. But yet these animals are in pens, they're on one spot. It's not nowhere near as natural. It's higher input, it's higher cost.
All the diesel to...
But they will over their one animal's lifetime, for instance, produce less. But they also, the nutritional content is proved, you know, grass-fed versus grain-fed beef in particular, the nutritional content for humans, the omega-6 to omega-3 ratios are very different, and the pasture-fed grain will beat grain-fed any day for human health. So, there's a lot of
animal health, because in coming from South Africa, where animals are, not all of them, but let's say half of the industry's beef and are in feedlots for the last 2 to 3 months of their lives. So they're grass fed up to that point. But there's a lot of rumen acidosis in systems like that. Their stomachs aren't, you know, naturally their stomachs don't want grain. They might like some grain, but they want grass. That's what they were, you know, how they designed. Yeah, designed. It's all good to look at it on paper and say, oh, well, this is a great system, this is a better system. But in the end, for, like you say, human health and then animal health, it's not a better system. I'm going to read these two paragraphs that you wrote. You said, we turn 7 tons of CO2 per hectare into enough feed for 10 ewes. So those 10 ewes each emit about 20 to 22 grams of methane a day, which means they produce in total 80 kilograms of methane per year. It's accepted that methane is a more potent greenhouse gas than CO2, generally regarded as 28 times stronger. If we multiply our use 80 kilograms of methane by 28, we get 2250 kilograms of CO2 equivalent. We are therefore using over 3 times more CO2 than we emit. And I like where you say, a car owner cannot say that, or a private jet going to a climate conference. There's so many memes out there of planes leaving climate conferences.
That's right, and it's not, and theirs is cumulative. So all the emissions that happen from all those activities, like aeroplanes and cars and all that, it's cumulative in the atmosphere. Methane is different in that it actually only lasts 12 years. And so if you're not increasing the total amount of methane in the atmosphere, it's just a sort of steady state, if you like.
What does Dr. Christine Jones say about this? Because I assume these conversations are kind of happening when she's here, when she's talking, because I haven't looked at any of her comment on this.
Oh, she's pretty scathing of it. I mean, she just understands natural systems. And I mean, like I so often say, let's stop talking about emissions and start talking about energy and ecosystems. And Christine Jones, as she says, you know, walk out into your garden, eat a pea, and it goes straight into your mouth, or take a carrot, and it goes from the carrot, the garden, to your home. We milk a cow. The milk goes from the bucket to the home. So the energy required is based all off solar energy.
Hmm.
But you start taking milk, going to a dairy factory and evaporating all the milk and making it into milk powder, well, suddenly the travel, the burning, the getting rid of all the water takes huge amounts of oil or coal to get that product. And so that's what she is often educating us about, is energy and ecosystems. So the whole methane, she just says, is a complete sideshow. It's not even relevant to how our planet can function in such an amazing way. And it's about understanding, you know, if you read the book Holistic Management by Alan Savory, it's just understanding the water cycle, the nutrient cycle, the energy cycle, and even the financial cycle, because you take any of those out of context and the system starts to fall over. And this is what I can't understand, that they now want to make and process seaweed to feed cows to drop their methane, but in the process they've used up a whole lot of diesel and energy getting it there.
So are we better off in the long run? And is that actually going to make any difference to the climate anyway, when you look at it as a whole? Yeah, so, you know, it's so easy to pull things, you know, and out and look at them in isolation. Yeah. But when you're dealing with nature.
Are you part of any of the schemes like NZFAP and those guys that kind of almost give you credits for the way you farm or not?
Oh, that's a great question. It's so funny because I was on the working group that came up with the NZFAP Plus. And I, you know, we were both really into it, thinking that, you know, the more we do, the more we're going to get premiums. And we've actually just gone the complete opposite direction. And we're NZFAP accredited, which is just the basics, saying we're doing all the basics well. But anything above that, we strongly oppose, because it actually achieves nothing. It's just ticking boxes, and nobody actually comes over your farm and looks at your whole ecosystem. They don't even understand it. And so why on earth would we want to pay anyone to come and tell us, you know, that they'd struggle to tell us what we didn't know?
I think... Yeah. And I was just going to say, I think what we also liked when we first looked about into regenerative was also that here was something that was actually farmer-led, but it's also better for the customers too, you know. Like, you know, you are actually genuinely trying to optimize the environment, you're trying to look after it. And so, you know, we were able to work that into our farm system in a way that we felt was environmentally friendly and good for the end users of our products, where they were, you know, minimum spray, minimum input, and looking after our environment, well, in a slightly different way. But we weren't demanding a premium for that product. So to our mind, and a South African guy was, you know, that's what he introduced us, to that concept, was that all of a sudden you can actually give value to the everyday person who's buying red meat or wool with no need for a premium. And you can do it at scale, and you can still maintain profitability on our business. So I think I've got a bit distracted, but we liked that theory, in that you know, as Hamish said, much of New Zealand sheep and beef farming is regenerative anyway, to a degree. And so if New Zealand was able to even just, you know, even with Fat Plus, was enough to sort of create that ideal, we're already very efficient and environmentally friendly. And if we could just build on that, it doesn't require a premium, and yet we can all still be environmentalists. We can maximize product, you know, optimize production, and you know, remain profitable with this Fat Plus and going to on-farm calculating of all the greenhouse gases. We don't see that as something that we are actually going to be rewarded for in the end by customers. I know corporate companies are all jumping on the bandwagon, and you know, trade partners, you know, a lot of them are indicating to New Zealand government that we need to do all these things in order to maintain that ability to trade overseas. But, you know, as farmers, we look at that and we say, well, we can't see that the customer, the end customer, the consumer, is actually going to want to or have the ability to pay in a large capacity for that extra work that we are going to have to do and we are going to have to pay for.
Well, I think it's just the middleman that's going to make money in the end. You're maybe not, you're going to make the same. The customer is going to pay more. The middleman is going to make the money. So, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, you take organics, which is essentially a niche market for the high end. I mean, not everybody in the world is able to pay a premium for what is, you know, considered a premium product in terms of natural and high quality and all the rest of it.
Well, after 30 years of an organic meat brand in New Zealand, they're only getting 30 cents a kilo premium. And they and let me assure you, they need 30% more, not 30 cents. And there's only one meat company now processing it because it's such small scale. It's less now than it was 20 years ago. And
it's so restrictive on farm in terms of meeting all the criteria, and that your production and your whole systems, you know, it's hard to remain profitable at that when you're only getting 30 cents.
Oh, it's hugely stressful, especially when you get into droughts and you can't buy in this feed and you can't do this and you can't do that. And we're very, very comfortable now of not expecting any premium. We've actually on the EOV, Environmental Outcome Verification, with the Savory Institute, which is an international brand.
Regenerative.
Yeah, and they come on to your farm and they measure 10 sites on your farm. So it's actual measurements. It's not just box ticking. And we feel that that's really good data for us. It's real data.
Yeah, and there's no real pass or fail, is there? It's sort of like a long-term sort of...
Improvement.
Yeah.
Yep, and in the end, if we do get a premium for it, yep, wonderful. We're actually getting a premium for it for our wool by a company that actually takes sustainability seriously, because at the moment, every company says they're sustainable, but they don't pay the farmer a sustainable price, so it's not sustainable. And whereas this company actually is giving us a just marginally sustainable price, but we had to be EOV certified. And we were happy to do that, and we think it's actually showing outcomes, not just telling a story.
I think it's very important what you were saying, that you're benefiting that end customer because, you know, they're getting less chemicals, etc., through the food. And I think regen is almost in a way just a rethink of organic, because organic really tried to do that, but then it had to be certified. And now then, it, like you said, it was a box ticking exercise. Yes. But it's interesting because I have gluten intolerance, right? And I couldn't eat oats. But when I started buying organic oats, whether, I mean, it's a box ticking exercise or not, I'm fine. I can now digest it. And it's a big part of my kind of diet pre-running and stuff like that. So I do pay more for organic, but I can see there's a difference in the way I digest it. And it's not just the product difference. I've been to other countries and buy organic there and I can digest it. And then I go on a hike and you use these kind of pre prepackaged normal conventional oats, and then suddenly it's like an issue for my stomach again. So I do feel that there's a lot more sitting in the nutrition space that we haven't even touched on. And I was listening to is it Dr. Zach Bush? He's speaking at Mark Anderson's forum. Is it Zach Bush? If I got his name correct.
Yes, that's right. On Friday.
Yeah, on Friday. Sorry. Friday. And I mean, there's a podcast where I can send it to you, where he talks about, you know, how nutrition is linked to how we produce food, and et cetera. All the older systems really had a detrimental effect on health. And it's really sad that this is the case. But I mean, this is how it was, you know. Agriculture progressed and it was good, but then it kind of just steamrolled out of control. It was good that people could be fed and that all these things were developed, but then somewhere it went from good to let's just make profits. And that's really sad.
Yes, yep, definitely. And even not just the profits, but, you know, the plant breeding, you know, as you say, just the conventional system, it seems like it has snowballed, you know. That optimum fertilizer level for your soil just seems to incrementally seem to creep up for some reason. You know, we demand more from our new pastures, our crops. So the breeding, you know, you can't have your cake and eat it too. So yes, to get a higher yield, something's got to give. And so that tends to be longevity. So yes, you get higher yield, but you get the higher yield for a shorter time, which means then you've got to go into your pasture and renew it, you know, more quickly, which is more sprays and it's more cost and time and, you know, potential soil damage. So, yeah, I think it's sort of all factors that we looked at, wasn't it, when we first got to the farm, that conventional, as you say. And in some ways, it was good just to rethink it because it is easy to snowball.
Were you, please continue.
Just an example on that is, we were pretty determined to go all grass, all pasture, no crops.
Yeah.
You know, because that's the ultimate system as far as we're concerned. We're animals, pasture, sunlight, water. Yeah. And, but we got three big droughts in a row.
Mm.
And after the first 2 years, we had to graze off our ewes or hoggets somewhere else. I mean, you know, there goes energy and there goes somebody else having to do the work that you couldn't do. And so I end up going back to growing kale crops.
Yeah.
And for the last 2 years, they're like insurance. They've really saved our bacon. Mm. Now,
well, I mean, we just preferred to keep it in house as opposed to send the stock off.
I guess what I'm saying is energy, you know, oil has to be burnt somewhere to keep our stocking rates up to be profitable enough to pay the bank, the debt, and all the costs associated. It's just the system we're in, and I don't think we're ever going to get out of it. It's just the way life is, and the expectations of people to think that we could go, you know, zero, no oil or whatever, is just a complete fairy tale.
I've got three more questions. The one is, how would bale grazing, would such a system fit in with you, or don't you have enough hectares?
No, we'll make 100 bales a half.
Okay.
Feed our 50 to 70 cattle. Same principle, but
okay. Yeah.
We'll probably, if it's a little bit of a hill, we'll break feed the cattle on that saved up pasture and just roll a hay bale per day down the hill, and it sort of spreads that fertility.
Yeah.
And it's such an easy wintering system. And
it tends to be shorter. Like overseas, you know, they would save really huge amounts of long rank pasture. Whereas when we do it, we would tend to shut it up for, you know, 2 or 3 months and then break feed it. So you've still got a decent amount of quality in the actual pasture is what we sort of found too, didn't we?
But the dairy farmers over here, they bale grazing's at a lot bigger scale because they obviously have to winter all their cows.
Mm.
Whereas our ewes, they don't get anything. They just get pasture through the winter. So we build up the pasture covers in the autumn. Well, hopefully we do. We're still looking for a lot more rain. and then they just winter on pasture the whole winter. It's such a
and our simple one or system. Two or three, well, you know, 10% of the farm that's in kale is for the young stock, so they're wintered on, you know,
like 5% of the farm.
So do you feel, is there a large enough group of other farmers that are starting to feel the same way as you, or do you feel like, I don't know what the right word is, I don't want to say like outcast or something, but do you, or is there enough support from farmer, from the farming side to support you in the, you know, in the region way, or are you still feeling a bit like you're kind of like outliers?
We've got a fantastic group down south called Regenerate South, which is dairy farmers, sheep farmers, all sorts of farm, like just doesn't really matter. I know we started off with about 10 of us in our lounge working out where to go from there. And I think we've probably got about 40 or 50.
Awesome.
That are in the group that turn up, you know, at times and not at others, but it's basically a group like-minded, willing to give things a go, and huge support. And ultimately, we just think change is done by farmers, not by anybody else, not by government, not by corporates, not by experts, but farmers all working together, giving it a go, improving. Some fall off, you know, it's just
trial and error.
Yeah, and a lot of trial and error. And, you know, our business, we've got our business riding on all this, you know, people with wages, big salaries, flash cars, electric cars, drive around, whatever. The success or failure of our business doesn't rest on them. And so skin in the game, and the change will come from farmers, and you can try, they can try all they like to try and change farmers, whatever that means. But
in terms of the greenhouse gases, that's what they...
Well, I suppose, yeah, in terms of greenhouse gases, whatever. But, yeah, ultimately, there's a quiet movement going on. And, yeah, that's, I guess that's why maybe the article resonated with so many people, because we're actually genuinely trying to improve our environment.
What questions should I be asking? Maybe let's start with you, Hamish, and then you, Amy.
To me, what's the define sustainability?
Yeah.
And then build from there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, I look at it and I say, well, what is farm level accounting for all this greenhouse gas emissions actually going to achieve? You know, I mean, as I said at the start, we're environmentalists, and we are seeking in our business to honour that, whether it's just on the land or what is the farm level accounting going to achieve for an end customer? Because when I look at it, I say, actually, potentially, we are going to be going away from what is natural and what is good for human health in terms of the product that we're producing. But I mean, that's just an estimation. I've got nothing to back that up apart from the omega 3 to 6 and the natural way that this methane cycle is. Another question would be to, yeah, do you understand the carbon cycle that we're talking about here in terms of livestock? Do we actually fully understand that CO2 carb, that cycle that comes down from the atmosphere, that in a whole farming system, we're absorbing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere down into the plants. Yes, the animals produce some methane, but as a whole farm system, calculating everything, the carbon, the methane, yeah, that would be the question I ask. Do people understand the basic carbon system as it relates to methane in livestock?
And just another thing, we really love diesel and petrol. We would not be here if it wasn't for those things. I think it's the most amazing miracle liquid. That full credit to whoever developed it. We've just used too much. We're abusing it. But let's not chuck the baby out with the bathwater, because I tell you what. Out of one barrel of oil, you make 6,000 products. Well, good luck exchanging our comfort in the Western world with any other forms of energy. So
I guess it's the same as fertilizer. I mean, we've overused it massively, massively. Yep. Right. Yep. And it's affects not only the atmosphere maybe, but it affects water and it affects even animal nutrition in the long run, our nutrition.
That's
but
right.
There's so many ways to cut it. And a lot of people, a lot of farmers that aren't even regen are telling me they're just cutting it massively and not listening to what the reps are saying, the fert reps are saying, and they're still getting results. And they've, you know, one farmer told me the other day on a dairy farm he's using 9 kilograms of nitrogen fertilizer per hectare. You know, that's a low amount. And he's been doing that for something like a decade. He's just quietly, he doesn't want to talk to anyone. He doesn't care. He's just going to do what he does. He's going to cut his fertilizer use and that's it. It's the same thing.
Absolutely. You know, there's no doubt that high fertilizer and all high amounts of input increase production. There's just no doubt about that. But, you know, in our business, we've managed to, you know, we might not produce as much as the same size unit with sheep and beef, but our profit is as high and our inputs are lower. So I suppose to a degree, it depends what you're after. And like that dairy farmer who's using less nitrogen, he's still got a profitable business. Mm. And so it's just, yeah.
And also just coming back to that tax, what does it achieve? And that's what I'm still asking the question. Please, someone tell me. Okay, so we get taxed $5,000 to $10,000 for the stock. Okay, let's drop 10%. What do we replace it with? Do we replace it with arable? And so our diesel per hectare goes from 10 liters to the hectare to 200, and our fertilizer triples, quadruples, and our sprays go from pretty much none to 5 times. Yeah. I don't understand. What else do people want?
And I mean, I suppose they think, well, let's convert a lot of that land. There's going to be a lot of land use change, and the government seem, you know, they've indicated that they're reasonably happy with that. You know, a lot of land will particularly come out of sheep and beef farms in New Zealand.
Into
forests, or maybe they think the better quality land can go into plants or intensive crops. But again, they don't produce methane, but you know, there's still a lot of diesel use, there's a lot of spray use, there's a lot of soil damage over and above what a sheep and beef. So yeah, you do sort of wonder.
Yeah. Hamish, thanks. I really appreciate I really appreciate your time. Hopefully we meet soon. So yeah, thanks for chatting to me.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah, absolute pleasure.
It's been easy. So no, thank you. It's good.
Cool.